Good evening, and welcome to the Halloween edition of Old School Guns. This is an interesting podcast. We're going to switch up the format for this evening. There'll be no question and answers, no political commentary, or really any Second Amendment commentary. Just going to tell some stories about some things that may be easily explained, may not be easily explained, who knows. And they at least obliquely involve firearms of some kind. You always have to wonder when you look back and think about some odd things that have happened in your life or that you've witnessed. And you go, what was really going on there? What was happening? You know, why did things unfold the way they did? Or what was that feeling of dread I had? Or that feeling of fear, that cold feeling of fear? What was all that? Was it just nerves? Was it just maybe a little PTS, post-traumatic stress from some, you know, previous encounter? Was it something or something else? Was it a legitimate reaction to something that's unexplained? A lot of people have to decide that for themselves and have to decide whether or not they believe in things beyond the physical, explainable realm of what goes on. And are things out there that happen? I mean, who has not had a feeling of deja vu? You're halfway through a conversation and you realize, I've had this conversation before. Or you're in your car. I've sat at this intersection before. I'm replaying something that has already happened, or that my mind already knows what the outcome is. I know what this situation is. Who hasn't had those feelings? I think almost everybody has. Are they explainable? And do they extend to other things? I mean, who hasn't gone in, if you're a gun enthusiast, who hasn't gone into a gun shop and you find a gun that you absolutely have to have, to the point where you don't really care? You're gonna buy it. You don't really need any time to make up your mind. Something about that particular item speaks to you, so you go ahead and action it, and you buy it, and you know, you keep it, and for some reason that you know it's meant to be with you, and you were meant to buy it, and it was there at the right time, the right place, the right everything, the right price, everything. So, you know, what is that? Is that fate? Is that some sort of other power operating? Who knows? And maybe it's nothing. Maybe it's just blind luck. Maybe it's completely explainable. And maybe it's just something that happens. Or maybe it's something else. We've all heard the remarkable stories of veterans who, decades after their service, they somehow get reunited with their service rifle. Back in the days, and it's easy to think of this with the M1 rifle, soldiers were required to memorize, just like with their service number or their parents' address, they would memorize the serial number of their service weapon, usually an M1 rifle or M1 carbine. And they would know it by heart. And decades later, they could be in a gun shop, or they could have just randomly ordered a rifle from the CMP, and lo and behold, it's their old service weapon. They still know the serial number, and they read it, and they can't believe it. And this has happened many times. They used to write these up in the American Rifleman when they would find out about it, but I'm sure it's happened more than that. Are some of the stories fake? Well, I don't know, but certainly some of them have to be true. Some of them have to be, where someone has found his old service rifle, going into, say, a gun shop, and finding a, you know, back in the 90s, the Korean imported M1 rifle that was, you know, sold to the Koreans, and then decades and decades later, they sell it back to an importer who brings them into the United States, and it's sitting on a gun shop shelf in the hometown of the veteran that was originally issued it in the Second World War or the Korean War. And they still know that number by heart. They know it. That was drummed into them. So that's one of those things. Is it just a coincidence that happens? Or is there some sort of an attraction? I don't know. But it's always very interesting to me that weapons seem to have some sort of a power or some sort of a value or some sort of a presence that's just greater than the sum of their parts. Looking at a Colt single action, most people think it's greater than the sum of its parts. It's beautiful, it's well-balanced, it's powerful, it's elegant, it's all those things. And many, many, many guns are in many ways the same way. And does this explain the fact that there seems to be this underground, behind-the-scenes movement to take guns away, to somehow deny us of these articles, these instruments, these objects? What is behind the international gun control, gun prohibition thing? It's not just a couple of wacky socialist politicians. It's not, you know, people like Tony Blair who did it in England in the late 90s. It's not, you know, the Beto O'Rourkes. It's not, you know, the people who are running the European Union. There just seems to be a larger, more submerged movement that wants to, and we know it, they've tipped their hat, they've let the cat out of the bag, or maybe it's the black cat out of the bag on Halloween. You know, they want total confiscation, and why is that? What is it about these objects that make them so afraid? And they've had a large measure of success around the world. Most countries in the world have very, very restrictive gun laws. They just do. And in England, it's basically been eradicated. Now, there's still a few things around, but nothing that they couldn't take at a moment's notice. And they're striving for it here, and we know that they want 100% confiscation. Who's behind it and why? Is it, you know, no one really wants to believe in Bilderbergers or the Bohemian Grove where there's all kinds of weird, all kinds of weirdness happens and all kinds of weird rituals and all these things going on. Nobody really wants to believe that there's something behind the scenes, that there's something behind elected politicians, there's something behind, you know, who is the man in Oz, you know, behind the curtain. And it's very odd. We get an odd glimpse now and then. But no one can really explain why international gun control is such an imperative. And no one can really understand why, you know, this has just become this hugely divisive and large issue when literally 60 years ago it didn't exist. Is it the dream of utopians? A way to establish the one world government that a lot of people believe in, that a lot of powerful people believe in? Is there a movement of the rich and powerful around the world to erase borders and erase laws and standardize laws and regulations so that their money can grow and they can become richer and even richer? Look like a James Bond villain. Is it something like that? Or is it maybe something older? Maybe something that's been transpiring for years and years and now is just getting powerful enough to make a genuine impact? We'll have to see. I think there is something out there. I just don't know what it is. But there is international control. There is an international movement. And that is genuinely scary. Okay, we'll move to a couple of stories that we've had come in and collected. And the first one comes from someone I know. And this individual was a member of a very elite military organization stationed up in the Pacific Northwest. And this man was an very avid outdoorsman. Pacific Northwest, in case you've not been there, you know, it's the base was called Fort Lewis. Now it's called Joint Base Lewis-McChord. You know, up in the Seattle-Tacoma area, very, 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 very wet, very, very cloudy, gray a lot of times. You know, a lot of that stereotypical things you hear about that part of the country and the raininess and all that. a very, very rainy, wet, dank, damp environment. Now, this man was a hunter. I mean, a big hunter, probably killed 30 or 40 deer, you know, in his adult life. And at this time, he was probably in his 30s, you know, in his mid-30s. So, you know, it's not unusual that during the fall deer season, he would go out and, you know, hunt deer. This was more of a tradition, and it's what he did every fall. That was the season he looked forward to. He told me about one hunt in particular. And again, it was a dank fall day, day off. And this man was a consummate woodsman. As I said, avid hunter, and then just because of his military duty and his love of hunting in the outdoors, very, very comfortable in the outdoors. More comfortable there than he was in an office. So he was a complete outdoorsman, a survivalist to, you know, a person who, if you crashed in an aircraft, he could get out and make all the emergency signals, scrounge for food, and do all that. He had all the field craft and all the survival skills that, you know, we kind of train people to have, to the point where he was an exemplar. He was the very, very best at it, one of the very best. But he told me about a hunt. He'd taken the deer rifle that he'd been using since he was a teenager, you know, fairly modest, you know, Remington bolt-action deer rifle with a, you know, fairly modest scope and, you know, nothing, certainly nothing high-speed, nothing what we would call military grade or anything. The average hunting rifle that, you know, millions of hunters use every fall. And as he told this to me, he got up on his day off, got up early, went out into the woods, and just from the minute he left his front door, he knew he was making a mistake. He knew that there was something wrong. And he knew, he just felt that it just wasn't right. It's one of those things where it just didn't feel right. But he continued on anyway, figuring, well, this, you know, this wasn't paying much attention to these kind of thoughts. He gets out into the woods and, you know, the sun's up and everything is there, but it's kind of dank. He notices the sky looks a little bit unusual. It's a little bit purple that he'd never really noticed, but didn't give it much thought, and doesn't even know if that meant anything or if that's just the way, you know, it was that morning. He didn't really know. He didn't really pay much attention. But he kept getting these feelings of fear and dread. Just fear and dread. Just isolation, fear, and dread. He's been out hunting hundreds of times before. Never felt anything like this. He moved around the woods for a few hours, did what he normally did when he was hunting deer. And then he just, these feelings of dread and fear were so overwhelming. He ran back to his car. Didn't just walk back to his car. He ran back to his car, where he put it. I assume it was a four-wheel drive truck because that's what he drove. But got back into his car, went back home, put his rifle away, and was just sitting in the living room. His wife comes home about midday and said, "Hey, I thought you were going to be hunting, you know, during the day and be gone hunting." And he looked at her and she said, "What's wrong?" And he said, "It's just these feelings I had out there. It was terrible." He goes, "I was terrified. It was terrible. I had these feelings of dread, these feelings I was being watched, that I was being hunted, that I wasn't the hunter, that I was being hunted." And he had all of these things. And gradually, you know, he calmed down and you know, things went back to normal. But a few days later, in the area he was in, some mysterious footprints were found. And it was footprints that have been attributed to the Sasquatch. And so his feeling on this is, his theory is, that he was in an area where the Sasquatches, maybe one, maybe plural, were. And maybe he was intruding on their area. And he admits that he is a pretty effective hunter. And one of the reasons he's an effective hunter is he will go over some a little bit rougher terrain than perhaps the average hunter, and that's due to the physical conditioning he had, the training. And you know, he said, I kind of go places where other people don't hunt. So he kind of thought that that was the reason. There may have been Sasquatches in the area, and somehow he sensed it, either maybe through his training, maybe it's just a coincidence, maybe it's PTS, but somehow he felt that there was another presence there and that he was in some sort of danger. He was being watched, and he was in some sort of danger. And what's more is, after a while, he did mention this to some trusted friends of his, saying, you know, I had a really strange experience. And he gives the details. And a couple of those guys came back to him and said, I felt the exact same thing. The exact same things happened to me. I've hunted hundreds of times, gone out into the woods on one occasion, and this feeling of being watched, this feeling of being hunted, this feeling of dread and fear. And the thing that he seemed to think was a unifying theme was this feeling of dread. Something's going to happen. It wasn't just a case of jittery nerves. It wasn't a case of I'm out in the dark alone. These were hardened guys, battle veterans, people who had been in very, very serious situations and prevailed and no problem, and had hunted, very experienced hunters, not the first time, not novices on anything. They were expert hunters. Some had even hunted all over the world, different places. So it was very interesting that this story kind of came out, and he told this to me, and his belief was there is something out there. It is called Sasquatch, and somehow he was just intuitive enough that people maybe do have that a sixth sense, or maybe they do have, in the military sometimes they call it spidey sense, maybe as people we do have that, and maybe we do, it does kick in, or maybe there's something primal about the Sasquatch that makes us avoid them and them avoid us. And when that doesn't happen, these feelings creep in. But that's the first story, the story of, you know, is there something out there in the Pacific Northwest? If I ask this gentleman if he believes there is, and he says unequivocally, there is something in those woods. Do I believe it? Well, I don't know that I disbelieve it, but I don't know that it's proven either. The other aspect of this story that's very interesting is he did not feel comforted by the fact he was armed. It wasn't the machismo thing when somebody's watching the Bigfoot movies or the Sasquatch TV shows and they said, well, if I just had my insert weapon here, I wouldn't be afraid. I'd kill him and I'd be rich because I would have, a deceased Sasquatch and I would prove it was real and be famous and rich. Wasn't any kind of feeling like that at all. Was not comforted by having a weapon that could clearly take down almost anything on the continent, on this continent. There are some interesting stories, and this is a family story, actually, about the positive power of guns and the positive power of a weapon. And this goes back to the late 1930s. My mother grew up on a small dairy farm outside of Lakehurst, New Jersey. They saw the Hindenburg fly over. They saw the light from its fire when it caught on fire. Very close, a very historical old area near, there's Mount Holly, Lakehurst, all of these areas. I've only been back there a few times. I've never lived there or never saw, you know, don't know it very, very well. But there was a creek, and this creek had a bridge over it, and the bridge connected, obviously, to, you know, a road. And that road had been there since, for centuries. As a matter of fact, it had been, you know, used during the Revolutionary War. And the story was, when the Hessians were either moving one way or retreating or doing something else, they had a cannon. and they took it over the existing bridge. Of course, that had been replaced probably 10 times since the Revolutionary War. And while they were moving this cannon across the bridge, something happened, something spooked the horse or whatever. And of course, inevitably, it goes over the side. And it's a large enough bridge that they, you know, this thing goes, sinks in the water, and it's gone. It's just basically gone. And especially in the wintertime there, it's not exactly warm. So nobody was going to go in diving, even if they could have located it in this creek, this little tiny river. Their ability to recover it was nil. They didn't have any kind of equipment or anything to do it. So there it stayed. And, you know, the legend always was there was a Hessian cannon in this creek. And that's just the local legend. Fast forward to the 1930s, 1940, just before World War II. My mother's family, she had several sisters and a brother. They would go and swim in this little creek. And by this time, you know, there was a nice swimming hole. And, you know, the bridge was nearby. Nothing really great. But there was this nice deep swimming hole. And the boys would all go down and dive to the bottom. And diving to the bottom was considered kind of this very cool thing to do and a rite of passage. I don't really know how deep it was, but however far a teenage boy can dive, I would imagine maybe 15 feet. I'm just guessing. Well, they discovered the cannon. And then it became the rite of passage was at the very bottom, was to go down and touch the cannon. So all the boys, and these boys actually became my uncles, and my mother's brother, her brother, my other uncle. They all went down and they touched the cannon. And every one of those boys wound up serving in World War II. And this is not, you know, they're serving and then they're serving, okay? They were serving as, one was a navigator, bombardier in a B-24, which was shot down over Poyesti. He bailed out and, you know, was saved. And even though he was missing in action, presumed dead, he did survive and, in fact, came back after the war and lived a long, happy life. Another one was a fighter pilot, actually joined the Royal Canadian Air Force to get into the scrap before Pearl Harbor. And so he was doing high-risk things. My uncle was a paratrooper who jumped into Normandy. And all those boys touched the cannon, and all those boys came back. So I don't know if there was a positive thing about touching the cannon. Was there some power there? Was there some protection? What was it, a talisman of some kind or a good luck charm? But the boys who went down and touched it all came back. And, you know, they dared, they touched it, and they were, by fate, rewarded, you could say. There were several other boys who did it too, and they came back. So, you know, that's kind of the local story there. I imagine nobody really remembers it anymore because they're all gone now. They're all gone, and no one has ever found the cannon. No one's ever found the cannon since, which has led to some speculation that, hey, you know, some divine power moved it up and put it there, and it became a good luck charm for the boys. Or maybe it was just a big smooth rock they found and not a cannon at all. But I think it was the cannon, and I think it was there for a reason, and perhaps it was something that offered them some protection. So it was the cannon, the Revolutionary War Hessian cannon. And I don't even know if the Hessians actually had cannons or if they borrowed them from the British or if they just had maybe a single salute gun or if it was a whole battery they were moving across the bridge. Who knows? But there was a cannon. It was lost. It reemerged right before the greatest war in history. And the boys who found it and touched it were lucky enough to come home. So that's the cannon right there. The cannon story. Powerful. As Native Americans would say, that was probably good medicine on the part of the cannon. I want to basically tell one more story. It's actually my story, and it's going to end the podcast. and it's the red truck. And I can tell you, I grew up on a ranch, a cattle ranch, extreme Northern California, right near the Oregon border. An absolutely, idyllic place for a kid to grow up. And I had chores to do, and after school, I've said on earlier podcasts, I had chores to do, and when I was done with those, I had a great outdoor lifestyle. I had a 410 shotgun, I had a 22 rifle, and fishing rods and all these things. There was a small creek that ran through our ranch, which had a couple of fishing holes in it, and it was pretty cool. One time I caught 23 fish out of one of the little fishing holes that was there, beyond the legal limit, but I'm sure the statute of limitations has run out now. I used to hunt doves and quail, not tremendously successful, but get one now and again, that kind of a thing. And hunt small game, there were rabbits and squirrels. Rabbits were pretty hard. They were it was jackrabbits, and they were pretty challenging. But ground squirrels, which actually had to be controlled because their numbers could get way out of hand, and in cattle country, their burrows represented a significant hazard to the beef cattle, which are of course an investment and very valuable. So you had to go basically control that population. So doing all that, there was just these wonderful little gullies and little valleys, little patches of woods in between the fields that were under cultivation. One of these ravines had some wrecks of old wagons and old buggies and things that were probably used in the late 19th, early 20th century. As they became obsolete, they were just kind of dumped there and allowed to decay, and there wasn't too much left of some of them, but there were frames and there were wheels, and there were several of them. There were probably I don't know, 9 or 10 wrecks of, the hay wagons especially were probably used up through the Second World War, because of the fuel situation, and horse-drawn wagons could still be used on a ranch to transport hay and other stuff, just at least around the ranch, not necessarily to town and back. But it didn't use any fossil fuel like a tractor or anything that would pull it would. So these things were wrecked there. It was very, very interesting. And it was always a glimpse to the past. I mean, on some of the other parts of the ranch, I found an old still, which, because there were some natural springs, we all know what spring water and, those contraption-looking stills and all that stuff. We all know what that all does. And you think back to the 1920s and 1930s. I mean, I'm sure that it probably was not the greatest stuff in the world, but it was probably commercially saleable hooch that they could make during the Prohibition, and even after Prohibition, when the Depression was there, and people didn't have a whole lot of money to spend on beverages. So, that kind of stuff was all there. And one of the oddest things that ever happened was, to give you just a little layout of the geography, the ranch was kind of a long piece of property, not strip, but a really long piece of property. And there was an old road which essentially bisected it and connected a highway with a county road. And at one end of it was our barns and a few other things. And we used this to access land that was on the other side of the highway. And we also used it to access, stuff around the barn area and all that. So, and this was not a developed road. This was not a county road. This was something that would look kind of more like a Jeep trail. It crossed the creek that I was referenced earlier, and it was at a ford. It didn't have a bridge or anything. So this was not something that you would really want to take a car down or anything, other than a pretty tough utility vehicle or a farm truck type of a situation, or a tractor. That's the kind of thing it was. So we started noticing, and it was it you never knew the time, you never knew when, but this old 1930s kind of rusty red looking pickup truck would stop. And this was early 30s looking, the big fenders, The cab was kind of had the slanted top on it. It wasn't late 1930s or 1940s. This was more like 1920s, maybe early 1930s. And would park there. And so we would go down to see who it was. And the minute the driver saw any kind of movement, he would drive away, just drive away. But, and then it might, a week or two might pass, some time would pass, and it would happen again. And we could never catch up. The ranch was 1,000 acres, so you can imagine that from where we were at the house to where this gate was from the highway connecting this service road that, this rough road that connected the county road with the highway, it would take you 10 minutes to drive down there. It was a long ways away. And I mean, you could see it through the binos we had at the time. But there was certainly no weapon that could range it. There was certainly no, it just was a far, a long way away. And by the time we would start moving, and we tried it several times, the guy would drive away and just be gone. And how did this truck, this old 1920s, 1930s truck, move that fast? Could never figure it out. Could never figure it out at all. And it just kept happening. And we never really saw the guy. We'd look at him, we'd look through binoculars, and you just couldn't see anything really distinct. There was a figure there, but the bino technology we had at the time, plus the distance, it was just kind of this cover deal. So we started asking around. We lived, 4 or 5 miles away from a small town. The town had 500 people in it. Everybody knew everybody. Everybody knew what everybody drove. There were no secrets. Everybody knew, when you saw a car coming down the road, you knew who it was. And nobody really had a truck like that. We kept asking around. Nobody knew anybody with a truck like that, a rusty red truck with black fenders. And it was, as I remember seeing it, it was kind of dirty looking. It wasn't showroom. It wasn't like it just rolled off a showroom. And it wasn't like it was freshly washed and waxed or anything. It was pretty much a survivor looking vehicle. And nobody knew who it was. Nobody had ever seen it. We had never seen it in town. Nobody had ever seen it. And it's not like this thing is going to be driving a whole long distance. This is like a 1930, maybe 1931 type truck. It just doesn't go anywhere. And we can't figure out who it is, who it belongs to. Nobody in town, nobody around the surrounding area has seen it or knows who this is. So it's really, really weird, So you don't really give it much thought. When you're out in ranch country, one of the things you learn about is when you've got a ranch, you spend time keeping unauthorized people off it because there are people who will go on your property and do things, whether it's something, fairly benign like hunting or just going around, to, perhaps doing something illegal or doing something that could start a fire. And of course, fires are a bad, big bad thing. So you keep people off your land. That's one of the drawbacks of owning a ranch or property like that. And you want to keep people from, I told you the story about messing with the cattle. The cattle are an investment, and you don't want people who are unauthorized hanging around there doing anything, because there was cattle rustling, there was stealing, there was, somebody could go in at night, kill a steer, and essentially butcher it and be gone by morning. So that you kept people off. You didn't allow people to hang around on your land, and you didn't. It was very odd that this guy kept hanging around this locked gate, and he was doing something. We just couldn't figure out what it was. So this came to a head one day. I was out bird hunting, and I was probably 500 or 600 yards away from the gate that this mystery truck always parked at. And so it was late afternoon, getting ready to head back to the house because there was a few little things to do around the house, a couple of animals to feed, and then get ready for dinner. And of course, kids are always ready for dinner. So I'm starting to walk back, and it's probably a 25, maybe even a 30 minute walk to get from where I was to where I needed to be. And I look, and I'm on the far side of the creek from this gate, and lo and behold, the red rusty truck with the black fenders is there. And there's somebody, I can see movement. I can't see much of what it is, because unfortunately, rather than having a 22 with a scope, which, you know, I could look through the scope maybe and see something closer, I had a single shot 410, which did not have the range or any of the attributes of the weapon you wanted at the time. And I remember being really scared. I didn't know who this guy was or what this thing was. The truck that nobody can catch, the man nobody knows, this thing apparently, you know, kind of just looking like it's out of the past, but it's too fast to catch. You know, it's all weird. It's all weird. So I get back to the house as fast as I could, and we basically, I alerted who I needed to alert, and so my parents, we went down to the gate, and what we found was really weird. The gate was off the hinge. It was one of those gates, it's a gate on each side, they meet in the middle, and you have the padlock and chain around it. And one of the gates was off its hinge and had been completely greased, so it could be lifted off the hinge easily, and we couldn't figure out why anybody would do that. And so it was just odd. Not so we actually fixed it, put it back the way it was supposed to be, and you know, I never saw that truck or anything ever again. And I asked my parents about it a couple weeks later, and here's what they told me. They told me that, well, it turns out that it was just this very, very old man, and he had been used to driving on that access road across the creek that connected the highway to the county road, and he didn't understand that he couldn't go that way anymore. So when he found the gate, he would bring grease because he didn't have a key to unlock the padlock, and he was just going to lift the gate off and open it and drive through, and then put the gate back on, presumably, and go his merry way up to the from the highway to the county road. And they said they found him, they had a talk with him, they told him not to do it, they told him to stay away, and that it was over. That was it. It was over. And so I accepted that. I was young enough, I accepted that. Oh, good, you know, parents handled it. You know, this is no longer going to be a problem. It's done. In the time since then, and I wish I had always asked them about it, I don't really know that that was true. I think they might have told me that just so that, you know, you wouldn't be afraid or whatever. I'm not sure that anybody ever found this old guy. I'm not sure that he was ever told not to be there. I'm not sure that his truck was anything more. You know, there are stories about people who can move maybe from one time frame to another. I don't know. Nobody knew this truck. Nobody in town had ever repaired this truck. This truck was just going, and it was, at the time, this was in the mid-1970s, we're talking about a truck that would have been like 45, almost 50 years old, 1920s construction, and it looked like it had not been that well cared for. It wasn't like, this is the truck I love and I'm keeping it the rest of my life type of deal. This was an old truck. Was it even from our time? Was it some sort of, did this guy just kind of come through some sort of a deal and wound up in 1974? Did he start out in 1930 and wind up in 1974 and couldn't figure out where he was, but knew he wanted to cross that road and get back home? Maybe that was it. That's the only thing I can think of, because we knew everybody in this area, and we never, ever saw that truck again. We never, ever saw an old guy, and it never, ever happened again. It was just weird, and it was just one of those things that I just cannot explain from my early life, that maybe they were telling the truth. Maybe they ran across him. Maybe it was an old guy who had an old farm truck and do that, but, you know, if he was living on his own farm or his own ranch, why would he bother to want to cross ours and go nowhere? It's almost like you have to have a purpose. And the weird part about it was, if you drove for maybe 15 minutes, you could circumvent this whole thing anyway. Now, I don't know about you, but when it comes to greasing and lifting a gate that probably weighs, and moving a gate that probably weighs 200 or 250 pounds, because this was a big gate so that combines and things could get through it. I'd rather drive another 15 minutes than wrestle with that, especially if I'm old, especially if I'm so old that I'm driving a 1930 pickup truck in 1974. You know, I would imagine that somebody who was doing that was at least, at the very least, in their late 60s or 70s or even perhaps their 80s, and in which case, it makes no sense. But in point of fact, he had actually lifted one of those gates off its hinges because we found it that way and nobody else did it. I mean, we used that gate a couple times a week. It wasn't like it was used every single day, multiple times. It would be used maybe three, four times a week. So we never understood what that was, and nor how it could just go away so quickly that it was almost like, well, hey, this isn't a problem. You know, we fixed it. It's not a problem. It's like, well, if it was that easy to fix, why did you fix it earlier? And well, you know, we just found this guy, and they never said his name, never said where he lived, never said anything. Just, oh, it was an old guy. We met up with him. It's not a problem. So I always felt that there was something weird, supernatural about that. It was not a young man. It was not a person. And I mean, this, as I said, this gate was so big, we'd move. Put earth movers and bulldozers through it. It was not a, this was not just a little tiny garden gate or anything. This was a big gate. And why would you would want to take it off its hinges as opposed to just breaking a lock if you really wanted to get through? I mean, it never made sense. And it but there was, you know, when we would see him down there, you always had this creepy feeling just looking at that old truck, looking at, you know, there was some sort of indistinct figure down there, you know, doing something. And I don't know. I don't know what that was. I don't know. Maybe it was nothing. But it's always come to my mind. It's always been one of those things that if something unexplained happened in my life, that's really kind of one of them. That's really one of them. And, you know, I do know that, you know, right around that time, my parents started taking home security and a few things a little more seriously. They were doing it a little more serious. We lived in an area where literally you could leave your house unlocked at night. You could go to town and leave your house unlocked. It wasn't a big deal because there was always somebody at the ranch. We had people. There was people there. There was, you know, and so there was always a lot of people around, so you really didn't have to lock it. But after that, there were some placement of guns that were closer, more accessible to the door. There were a few other things done to tighten up security. Whether it was related to the red truck with the black fenders, I don't know. But definitely, it was very, very creepy. And you know, all I have to say is that's unexplained. Anyway, thank you for listening to this edition of Old School Guns. This is the Halloween edition, and although it probably did not scare you out of your pants, you know, there are a few unexplained things, and there are more unexplained things out there. So, again, the truth is out there, and we'll see you on the next podcast. But for right now, this is Old School Guns out.